Like the book business itself, the Frankfurt Book Fair is undergoing a metamorphosis, but while publishers continue their own transformations, the fair organizers have already emerged from a chrysalis with a new kind of show. In Reviews, a photography collection contemplates slavery and its legacies. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and each week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of the news that has everyone in publishing talking. And joining me from New York is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor. Welcome back, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
And indeed, welcome back to back home, because you were over in Frankfurt the last time we talked, and presumably you're over that jet lag and have some thoughts about what the 2012 show was like.
Yeah, well, I'm getting there. I'm almost over my jet lag. And I am definitely sifting through the many storylines that emerged in Frankfurt this year. And I have to say, 2012, in hindsight, was a very impressive edition of the fair. And I, for one, think it was emblematic of the kind of change that we're beginning to see in the publishing world in general. So when we last talked from the floor of the book fair, you know, we didn't have final numbers for the fair, but as it turns out, the attendance was roughly flat with 2011. It was down just about 1.6%. And that is an amazing accomplishment considering the fiscal crisis now hitting the Eurozone. But when you add the public attendance days in, the fair attendance was actually up over last year by a full point. So, you know, that really caught my eye. They actually managed to surpass last year's attendance in the midst of this great, you know, financial crisis in Europe. But what really caught my eye is that the rights trade was up by a healthy 18%. There was more traffic in the rights center. There were more appointments, and there were a lot of deals. Even though you may never see the blockbuster deals of shows past, you are now seeing quite a few. The volume is definitely increasing. The professional program in the Frankfurt Academy was also very impressive. The Frankfurt Academy holds programs on various things like EPUB 3, HTML5, licensing, merchandising, all these sort of real-world nuts and bolts issues, and they bring together players from all kinds of industries. That attendance was up by over 10% from last year. That's a very impressive showing, and I expect that to grow by leaps and bounds in the coming years as well. So the Frankfurt Book Fair, as you alluded to, has really succeeded in doing what the larger published community is still sort of in the process of doing. It's pulled in new players, like app makers, for example, and others who may not have considered themselves publishers in a traditional sense, but are very much part of the industry going forward. And another thing we saw at the fair this year was new ventures like Bookshout and Texter. And you can read about them on the PW website. They were announced at this year's fair. And I have to say, companies like this, if they were launched a few years ago, would have been greeted with a sort of wary eye, possibly targeted for lawsuits or possibly otherwise shunned. But this year, they were sort of brought into the fold rather quickly. We'll see if that continues. But I was impressed with that. So, and you can check out all our coverage of the Frankfurt show on our PW website. That includes all of our show dailies that are available there and numerous other stories that we filed. And speaking of the PW website, I'll just manage really quickly that we had a redesign that went live last week, and I think it's wonderful. So please check out the new site, and you can give us your feedback on the new site as well.
Yes, indeed. Well, congrats on the new design. And I find that fascinating, this notion that publishing, at least at the Frankfurt Book Fair, is closer to reconciliation with technology than it has been before.
Yeah, really. I mean, there's always been this sense of sort of fear of digital. I didn't see that at all at the show this year. It's been diminishing for the last 3 years, maybe, since Frankfurt really sort of began pulling in digital as a main part of its program. But this year, I didn't see much fear at all. In fact, I saw a lot of people very excited for the future.
And indeed, though, the evidence continues to mount that the future is here. It's not somewhere down the road a bit. You've got some numbers to share with us on that score.
Yeah. In Monday's issue, we're going to have a roundup of sales numbers released by the AAP for the first six months of 2012. And they're magnificent. You know, simply put, they're up, you know, they're really good. They're up 14% over last year for adult trade titles. That's a big bump. Now, part of that, of course, is of course, the 50 Shades of Grey effect and the Hunger Games, you know, the blockbusters of 2012 definitely helped to pump up the sales. But the numbers also show some juice pretty much across the board. You know, e-books are jumping significantly again, no surprise there. You know, the exception is mass market paperbacks that are down. Those mass market paperback sales are down about 20%. But, you know, the obvious question looking at this big jump for books is whether or not the industry will be able to sustain it as the Hunger Games and the 50 Shades phenomena begin to fade away in 2013. But I really believe there is an opportunity here, and I'm especially convinced of this based on what I saw in Frankfurt, the fact that there was, you know, less fear and more willingness to embrace digital. You know, I'm really convinced that reading is in a very good place right now. And so I'm hoping publishers are going to use this latest sales news to, you know, to use a sailing metaphor to launch the spinnaker, to, you know, turn into the wind and to really kick things up a few knots.
I like that metaphor indeed. And even if, as you say, reading is in a good place right now, there are some parties in some familiar copyright infringement cases that are getting into a tight corner. And indeed, the decision that we talked about last week in the Haiti Trust case, that was a big win for libraries and for Google, and a loss for a party we hear a great deal about in all these cases, the Authors Guild. There's some news around that, and you've got some impressions as to where this is going to lead us in the future.
Yes, absolutely. We spoke about the HathiTrust decision, which, you know, deals with the libraries and Google's book scanning that happened, of course, while I was in Frankfurt last week. And, you know, now I've had time to get back in the States and look over the decision a little more and talk to some more people. And I have to say, it's worse than expected for the Authors Guild. Last week, I said that I expected that this would probably increase the pressure on the Authors Guild to sort of settle and dismount from its litigation against Google over its book scanning. Well, upon further review, that's not going to be easy for them. Because in addition to the epic beating they took on the fair use question, and they really did, that the decision was fairly emphatic for fair use advocates, Judge Baer also dealt the Authors Guild a real blow on a minor procedural issue. Specifically, Baer found that the Authors Guild, while it did meet constitutional requirements to be an associational plaintiff, it lacked statutory standing within the Copyright Act itself. And I'll explain that. In other words, because the Copyright Act specifically states that only legal or beneficial copyright owners can sue for infringement, all other parties are excluded, and that includes the Authors Guild. So the net effect of this, as it stands right now, the Authors Guild is permanently barred from bringing copyright lawsuits on behalf of its members. And that was explained to me by a number of lawyers, including James Grimmelman, who's now a PW contributing editor. And the fact is, unless the Authors Guild can get that decision overturned on appeal, it's going to stand as something of a blow to their institutional status as a legal advocate for copyright owners. So that right there virtually assures that we're going to have an appeal on this HathiTrust case. You know, I was probably thinking there would be anyway. I was, you know, thinking maybe a settlement would happen, but I think for sure now you're going to have to see an appeal on this. You know, and as we've talked about, you know, there's a lot of second guessing coming now with after this decision as well. You know, the publishers have since left the field of battle with a very bare bones settlement in recent weeks. But the AG, in opening this second case against the HathiTrust, have really put themselves now in a very, very tight spot. We have an emphatic ruling for fair use on the books, and that ruling in this case, which only asked for injunctive relief, now stands to really hobble their other case, which is an expensive big class action suit against Google. I've always questioned this legal strategy, as you know, and I've always questioned the wisdom of bringing a lawsuit over book scanning because I really didn't see the harm to authors here. But even I didn't fully anticipate the extent of how badly this could turn out for the AG. And taking this litigation to the bitter end, they've already done the opposite of their stated goal. They've legitimized book scanning, and in the process, they're now blocked from bringing associational copyright lawsuits in the future. So that is a really, really bad outcome for them. Now, I will raise this caveat, that it's not over. It's not over by a long shot. You know, anything can happen on appeal, and this will certainly be appealed. So none of these gains have been solidified yet. Anything can change. But as copy law attorney and blogger Lloyd Jassen told me this week, it looks a little like Vietnam, where, you know, it was easy to get sucked into the battle, but years later, there's really not an easy way out.
Yeah, well, I'm not much as a copyright law expert, but I certainly am an expert on the law of unintended consequences. And that sounds like that's what's happened there for the Authors Guild. Andrew Albanese, features editor at Publishers Weekly, thank you so much for your report this week.
My pleasure.
And now we want to turn for the week's review review of reviews. We've got Samuel R. Slayton, reviews editor at PW Online. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Sam.
Glad to be back, Chris.
Well, it's good to have you join us again this week. And what books have you brought?
Once again, we're starting with fiction, where we have two boxed reviews from a couple Brits. Sebastian Falk's A Possible Life is a masterful book that links the stories of five disparate lives into a long meditation on the intersection of fate and free will. Five discrete novellas range from 1800s France to Italy in the year 2029, examining how choices, impulses, and luck shape lives. What Falk risks sounds twee and clever, and not unlike what David Mitchell did in Cloud Atlas, but this book transcends pat tropes through the beauty and clarity of Falk's prose. Each world is drawn with precision, creating widely varied stories that are intensely absorbing, with language flowing and eddying to suit each one. Though there are subtle connections, characters' lives never cross. They are very much in their own worlds. Falk resists assembling his parts into a thumping moral. His book is both bigger and less ambitious than that. It's a contemplation of human existence on the individual level. In screenwriter Lisa O'Donnell's debut novel, The Death of Bees, 15-year-old Marnie Doyle finds her father's body on the sofa of their seedy Glasgow home and her mother hanging in the garden shed. She and her younger sister, Nellie, decide to bury them both in the back garden. Fearing that social services will put them into foster care, the girls undertake a desperate charade, claiming that Jean and Isabel are off on a trip. Notorious druggies and neglectful parents, at first their purported abandonment seems plausible. Things get complicated when their neighbor, a lonely gay man recently arrested in the park for indecency, and the girl's grandfather begin to fight over who should take them in.
Well, that is one complicated plot line, Sam.
Exactly. It doesn't sound like very much fun, but a heavy read doesn't necessarily make for a bad read. We also spoke in next week's issue, we spoke with debut author Ayanna Mathis about her elegant, sure-footed debut, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, which we mentioned in last week's review of reviews. Mathis told us how she drew inspiration from her own family for the book. When I was young, there was a rift, and my mother and I didn't have a lot to do with my extended family through my teen years. They became sort of mythic beings. Writing Hattie, says Mathis, was her way of, quote, imagining herself into a family she didn't have much contact with. She goes on to say, I thought a lot about the Great Migration and how it would be to be the first generation born in the North. I think it's an important American story. We do, too. In our review, we called it a remarkable debut, woven with confidence.
And in the mystery and thriller section is a literary suspense novel that features, of all professions, an architect.
At the start of Jennifer McMahon's The One I Left Behind, a haunting novel of literary suspense, architect Reggie Dufresne receives a phone call that changes everything. Her idolized mother, Vera, who was snatched from her by the notorious serial killer known as Neptune when Reggie was 13, has been found alive. For the first time in 25 years, mother and daughter return to Brighton Falls, Connecticut, where Vera was abducted, and where Neptune may still be operating. Edgar Award winner Bruce De Silva also has a signature review of Dick Wolf's first novel, The Intercept. Stunning plot twists, graphic violence, and a frantic pace mark this thriller from the creator of TV's Law and Order, involving a thwarted terrorist attempt to hijack a cross-Atlantic airliner and the 4th of July celebration of the upcoming dedication of the new World Trade Center Tower, to be attended by both President Barack Obama and former President George Bush.
In romance, what have you got?
In the anthology Duty and Desire, Military Erotic Romance, editor Christina Wright assembles 18 red-hot tales of men and women in uniform that range from World War II-era Russia to modern-day Afghanistan. This collection celebrates the valor of those who serve their country and loves of all kinds, straight and gay. But it also explores darker issues like disabling injuries and post-traumatic stress syndrome. Standout stories include Sachi Green's Sergeant Ray, a tale of two female soldiers sharing their lives together after one becomes a paraplegic while saving the other's life in Iraq, and Christine Dabo's Wilco, which serves up BDSM with a twist, a female junior officer and her submissive male superior. Romance veteran Isabella Bradford should please fans with the third entry in her Wilder Sisters Regency series, When the Duke Found Love. The youngest Wilder, Lady Diana, wants to please her family and rid herself of a bad reputation for consorting with Rhodes. While she's being courted by the stuffy Lord Crump, Diana ends up flirting instead with the handsome, witty Duke of Sheffield. He becomes betrothed to another to please his family, but gradually realizes that Diana is his true love. Bradford's effortless plotting and winning characters make this a satisfying conclusion to her trilogy.
Well, you certainly make that Regency romance sound appealing. What have we got for science fiction?
Jim Butcher's Cold Days shows the author continuing to up the ante for wizard Harry Dresden in another engaging urban fantasy that leavens apocalyptic threats with smart-ass humor. Harry's 14th outing finds that the Chicago-based private investigator has been barely slowed down by being killed and is now working as a hitman for Mab, the Queen of Air and Darkness, who is forbidden from killing mortals. Though there's plenty of backstory, newcomers to the series shouldn't have much trouble getting caught up in the action or connecting with the charismatic lead. Sandra O'Dell's The 12 Ways of Christmas is a collection of 12 stories, each inspired by a line from the traditional Christmas carol. Ranging between sci-fi, horror, steampunk, and fantasy, every offering has its own voice, setting, and style. In the humorous A Free-Range Panic at Alanda Farms, farm produce takes control of its own destiny. The sweetly sad Swan Song shows soldiers dealing with the transition between life and death, and A Milk of Human Kindness turns the maids a-milking into ghostly rescuers of abused wives. This is a bewitching enterprise where the connection between lyric and story rarely stretches thin.
And we'll turn now to nonfiction, Sam, always a favorite for me, and a couple of star reviews this week, including a collection of photography that gives us a really realistic glimpse of what it was like in the days of slavery.
In Envisioning Emancipation, Black Americans and the End of Slavery, a collection of nearly 150 photos from the mid-19th to the early 20th century, Deborah Willis, a professor of photography at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, and Barbara Krauthamer, a UMass Amherst historian, bring their special expertise to a stunning range of images that allow us to contemplate not only the history of slavery and emancipation, but also our continued ties to that history and its legacies. The result is a gem that is by turns haunting, touching, troubling, inspiring, and informative. For Selected Letters of William Styron, Styron's widow, Rose, a poet, translator, and activist, and University of South Carolina historian R. Blakesley Gilpin have collected, transcribed, and annotated this fascinating trove of letters charting Styron's development as a man and as a novelist. From Duke University to a World War II VD ward, through the success of his first novel, Lie Down in Darkness, and beyond, Styron emerges as a witty, tender, and intelligent correspondent. Devotees of American literature will be especially gratified to find missives to a pantheon of 20th century American greats, including Norman Mailer, Henry Miller, George Plimpton, Dorothy Parker, Robert Penn Warren, Philip Roth, and more. We also have a starred review of Vicky Leon's The Joy of Sexus, Lust, Love, and Longing in the Ancient World. In concise entries divided into 9 sections, Leon delivers a snappy and scandalous ride into the stunning, barbaric, and always entertaining sexuality of the ancient world. From aphrodisiacs and diaphanous silks to abduction and the very upsetting practice of infibulation, she minces no words exposing the truth behind ancient sex practices. Infamous emperors with a penchant for young boys riddle the pages, but so too do unsung tales of intimacy and affection. Leon's is definitely not the ancient world you studied in high school. We've also got a review of Luke Dempsey's hilarious and humongous Monty Python's Flying Circus, All the Bits. This annotated transcription of all 35 Monty Python episodes occupies a ludicrously colorful and silly space between scrapbook and Bible of the Absurd, including stills of over 2,000 key scenes, as well as a litany of trivia for each sketch. This is a perfect supplement to the British troops' subversive comedic oeuvre.
You know, Sam, I think we all know someone who would just love to have that book, although I bet a few of the friends we have might even be able to recite all those episodes without the book's help. In children's, we start out with some picture books.
That's right. On the picture book side of things, we have a review of Leave Your Sleep, the first picture book from singer-songwriter Natalie Merchant. Illustrated by Barbara McClintock, The collection of poems is based on Merchant's 2010 album of the same name, which featured songs adapted from poems for and about children. The poems in Leave Your Sleep include works from Ogden Nash, E.E. Cummings, and others, and the book is packaged with a CD featuring 19 of Merchant's recordings, which engage with genres that include klezmer, Dixieland, and Zydeco. McClintock's nostalgic illustrations, meanwhile, channel some diverse sources themselves, at times recalling the work of Randolph Caldecott and E.H. Shepard. Among our fiction reviews is a debut novel from Chris Howard called Rootless, and yes, it's set in yet another ruined future Earth. In this one, locusts have devoured nearly all plant life, leaving genetically engineered corn as the only food source. But Howard's world feels both fresh in its conception and gritty in its reality. It follows a teenage boy named Banyan, who creates metal trees as a link to the past as he searches for his father and the rumored last trees on Earth, gathering allies along the way as he braves cannibals, pirates, slavers, and more.
And that does sound like a lot of nonstop adventure. Finally, here's something that just intrigues me a great deal. For the pick of the week, it's about a rather unusual collection.
Yeah, if you manage to get through the 800 pages of Monty Python's Flying Circus, this is another great coffee table book. For our pick of the week, we went with Simon Manchester and Nick Mann's Skulls. Digging deep into Alan Dudley's collection of over 2,000 skulls, Winchester, author of The Professor and the Madman, photographer Mann highlight the rarest and most of the vaunted cranium connoisseur's world-class assortment, which is housed cozily in a spare upstairs bedroom in his home in England. Grouping the skulls according to species, Winchester enthusiastically educates armchair osteologists on the peculiarities of key subspecies, enabling readers, should the need arise, to tell a long-nosed from a southern brown bandicoot, the bizarrely horned babirusa from a warthog, or the fearsome and extinct saber-toothed cat from a modern endangered tiger. Coupled with Mann's crisp, reverential photography, this is one coffee table book that's hard to put down.
Well, indeed, and you know, I just wonder sometimes if those two who are have this collection, they might be thought of as head cases, right?
Exactly, yes. It's a really bizarre upstairs spare bedroom to have, for sure.
Indeed. Sam Slayton, reviews editor at Publishers Weekly. Thanks so much for this week's Review of Reviews.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
And Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.